Hey guys, thanks for tuning in to episode 49 of Sheer Crime. I'm Amy.
And I'm Kenzie.
Today, we are covering another installment in the Netflix series Catching Killers, this time on the Green River Killer. Many believe that the worst serial murders occurred in the 1970s, but Portland in 1988 through the late 90s had a monster on the loose with a taste for blood. Over the span of almost two decades, women and girls were disappearing at an alarming rate, their bodies dumped primarily near the Green River. What did most of them have in common? They were all women who worked the streets at night and involved in prostitution. Despite that, detectives refused to give up and kept the search going for these young girls. But at a time when DNA testing was in its infancy, samples were collected but sat cold for many years. That is, until finally, they were able to connect the dots and apprehend the man who'd evaded capture all that time. Let's dive in. Can you hear me?
A little bit, yeah.
Oh, I'm like, oh,
no, it's okay. No, I'm just waiting for you to bring us in.
Oh, yeah. How this works.
I'm just staring at you while you eat.
I was like, am I being really loud right now? Because I thought I wasn't. Oh, God. Okay. Well, hi, Kenzie.
Hi, Amy. That was a fun start.
It was rough, but we made it.
We're still kind of getting back into the swing of things, I don't hold it against you at all.
I mean, somebody should, because that was awkward as shit.
I'm just staring at you to, like,
that was
stare at
so
you eating.
Funny. I literally was just like, what is she doing? Like, am I being that rude right now? I can't even hear it.
That's so funny.
How are you?
I'm doing great. We're back kind of on our normal scheduling and getting our episodes in and recorded. And we're kind of doing a little bit more today, actually. We're doing two episodes. We're recording
we
two.
Are.
Which is great. Helps us get back on track. Helps us get things going again.
Yeah, get some episodes ready and like in the barrel so that we can just start releasing again.
Yes.
So one thing that we had talked about, I don't know if we only talked about it in the Facebook group. I feel like we also brought it up in an episode or two.
I think we did a few times, but
a while
I could
ago.
Be wrong. Yeah, it's been so long. I just can't remember.
A hot minute. But we had talked about, you know, wanting to release episodes more often. The issue is that we, A, have to pay for editing to have it happen that fast because you have a life and literally cannot just sit and edit these all the time.
Right. Right.
It takes
a
lot of time. And I miss being able to, like, hand it off to the editor.
Yeah.
Don't you?
Yeah. Well, it was so much easier at that point. It was really easy. He'd have it done in, you know,
like 2 days.
2 days. It was done and ready to go. And obviously, he was professional.
Right.
I did it by learning on YouTube. That is as far as my expertise goes for editing.
Yeah.
I don't think I do a bad job at it, no. But it just takes me a long, long time because I do not have the software and the capabilities to do it a lot faster than that. So, yes, it was a lot nicer for sure.
So we have come up with a bit of an idea, and this may or may not ruffle feathers. Maybe some people are going to be like really excited about it. I think it's kind of a decent way to do this. But basically, at this point, we are not able to do a Patreon yet because that would require us to, well, have a lot more episodes on deck. And we just can't do that at this time, again, because we can't edit them. So instead, what we thought is that if we wanted to get back to weekly episodes, and if you want to hear weekly episodes, we're all for it. We just need a little bit of help because we cannot fund this shit on our own.
Right.
And we don't make anything off of this, just so that you all know.
Yes. This
we lose money on this deal.
We literally. Just do it because we enjoy it and it is a fun hobby for us.
Right. So we were thinking, I went ahead and got a Cash App account set up for Sheer Crime so that if anybody feels like they would want to donate any amount of money, I even thought if we get like 500 listens per episode and each person donated 50 fucking cents yeah. or a dollar, like that would cover immensely editing yep. fees and whatnot. And then that way we would be able to bring you episodes every single week.
Right.
So if you're interested and you would like to help out the cause, our handle is $SheerCrimePodcast. And what we'll do is we will also add this in the show notes. So I'll put this in the description so that you can see it exactly as it's actually written. And we'll post it in our Facebook group as well.
Yes.
The funds, again, are not going towards us. They are literally being dumped right back into the podcast and being able to do that. If we somehow got like an obscene amount of donations, maybe we could look into some merch at that point.
Yeah, for sure.
Like that would be fun. And then just start giving it away.
There's lots of options. Be paid for.
Yeah.
Yep. And there's no obligation. There's no obligation to do this. We wanted to give, I know we've been hearing it a lot from listeners that they would like more episodes and they can't wait for our episodes to come out. And just the way that life is, we both have two kids. Life is crazy. And it takes, I mean, it could take anywhere from 12 to 15 hours to edit one episode. And that's on the shorter end. If it's only an hour or so, the longer episodes can take longer for me. So yeah, there's no obligation at all, but we wanted to throw it out there. And if you guys want to donate, that would be wonderful.
That would be amazing.
Amazing.
I don't know why I felt like
you're
amazing.
You're amazing.
What did you bring for us to drink today?
We are drinking wine again, and yes. we're probably going to end up finishing the bottle.
I think that's our goal.
I mean, we have two episodes to record, so we're definitely going to finish the whole bottle.
Yeah.
And it is the Apothic Crush. I love Apothic in general.
I
like
so do I.
all of their blends. They're very, very good, but I really like the Crush. So yeah. we're not doing our favorite Roscato this time.
Nope.
But Apothic is just as good, and
personally,
we like it very much.
I think this one's going to get us a little bit more drunk.
I think so, too. It's definitely stronger
it's
than Roscato.
Yeah. So I'm all for it. I mean, I'm also feeling sweaty already.
Right? I know. I've already taken my sweatshirt off, you guys.
I'm about
it's
to do the
It's already happening.
Same.
I'm getting hot.
It's getting hot in here.
We've been recording for 2 minutes.
These chicks are drinking wine. Right. I've right. taken one sip and I'm already like, woo.
Well, let's cheers to that.
Let's cheers to that.
Wonderful.
Once it hits the lips.
It's so good.
It's so good.
So
and you
great.
Also brought chocolate.
I did. I brought us some M&Ms to go with our wine.
Okay. So quick side story. The other day, I'm on a Teams meeting with the woman who is training me at my new job, Jenny. And she's sharing her screen to show me how to do something. In the meantime, I take a, like, what is it? The little rectangle of like a Hershey's chocolate bar,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
We had some left over from like, I don't know, making s'mores last year.
Yeah.
Literally, it's like a year old chocolate bar. I was desperate. I took a square, shove it in my mouth. I have a problem with inhaling when I should be swallowing. I inhaled the chocolatey spit from the back of my throat and started gagging and coughing to the point where I was like, I might pass out and die right here. And I'm trying to tell her, just a second. But I'm coughing.
Right.
She gets quiet. So she obviously like heard me. And when I'm all done, I mean, literally, I am like sobbing tears. There's snot coming out of my nose. I'm a mess. And I'm like, I'm so sorry. As I'm like choking.
Yeah. Yeah.
And she's like, it's fine. And I'm like, I'm just so glad that you didn't see any of that. And she goes, no, I did.
I saw the whole thing.
And I'm like, what? She's like, oh, yeah, I saw the entire thing. And I'm like, awesome, because I thought she was sharing her screen. She couldn't see me.
Oh, yeah.
So I didn't duck away from the computer. It was full on, full frontal, Amy choking on a piece of chocolate. What?
Oh, my gosh.
Death by chocolate.
Oh, almost.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So that happened.
Hey, but it's worth it. If it's chocolate, death by... I'd take that death over other deaths. If I had to choose, I'd take it. That's a good way to go out.
It was the first square, Kenzie. I couldn't even say that I got my full like chocolate fix done. Had it been the last one, take me.
Yeah. You didn't even really get to experience chocolate yet.
And then at that point, the back of my throat felt like it was burning
oh,
for
I'm
the
sure.
rest of the time eating it. So yeah. it was not even... I was pissed. But you brought M&Ms.
I did bring M&Ms, so that'll be a great fix.
So I might choke on one of these. We'll see. Now that I am done regaling you with my amazing story.
I loved it.
Of near-death experience. I'm going to let you go ahead and start us off on the Green River Killer.
Perfect. So with this episode, we start off right off the bat and meet Dave Reichert. He is the former lead detective of the Green River Task Force in King County, Washington. We learn that his wife, Julie, was the one who really pushed and encouraged him to become a police officer. His kids were really, really proud of him. They could tell all of their friends, "My dad is a police officer." I can imagine being a kid in school and having a parent that has a cool job like that.
Yeah.
I mean, back then, everyone wanted to have a dad that was like a police officer or a fireman or something like that. It was like the cool job to have.
Yeah. My dad has been retired my whole life. So I never got to like.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh my gosh. That is crazy.
Yeah, I think he retired at like 45. Yeah. Because I was born when he was 48.
Amazing.
Yeah.
I will be retired at 45.
He's a fucking genius. Like literally a certified genius.
Yeah.
And well, yeah. He also like worked with a company that developed the technology for microwave ovens.
I think you told me that.
Yeah.
That's right.
So I think I told you, like, he installed the first microwave oven on Air Force One.
Yeah. That's amazing.
Yeah. But yeah, so no, he didn't work.
I mean, but you're still probably proud of your dad.
I mean, super proud of my dad. My mom, on the other hand, I'm just kidding.
Yeah.
I love you, Mom. She worked hard. She worked hard for the money. I don't know why I keep singing. It's the apothec.
Yes.
Keep going.
Sure, the apothec.
I'm just
going
to sit back and choke on my chocolate.
Sounds good.
Sounds great.
I'll keep going. Now, Dave was recruited in 1972, and by 1979, he was asked to start working in the homicide and robbery unit. This was a really big moment for him because this had always been a really big goal and a dream of his. I think that probably is to stand for a lot of police officers.
I mean, I can relate. That's the unit that I'd want to
be right. in. 1,000%.
Like Vice? No thanks. Homicide?
I'd love to be a detective.
Sign me up. Ugh.
So cool.
I wanted to be Clarice Starling so bad. So bad.
But I didn't realize that it takes you a while to become these things. Like, you can't just, like, be a detective. You have to, like, be in the force for many, many, many years and get promoted to detective.
Yeah, it's like, I don't have that kind of commitment.
No, absolutely not.
No.
Not nowadays.
No, I am so good at giving up.
Yeah.
It's just not a thing.
I'm too good at it.
Yeah, too good.
We're now at 1982, and Dave tells us that on August 15th, they received a call that two bodies had been found in the Green River. When he got there, one of the bodies was naked in the water about 3 feet down. As he continued walking down there, he encountered a third body. It was extremely shocking, and you could really feel the tension in the air with all of the officers that were present on the scene. And before these three were found, there were two others found previously within the last month. So
that's crazy.
Already bringing it up to 5 people. That is nuts. That's
so
a lot of people in the same area. What the hell is going on?
Right.
Another point to make, all of them had been strangled.
Right.
Every single one. So now we have a connection between all 5 of these bodies. This was the point when they knew they could be looking for a serial killer and that this was going to be a major investigation. Dave never spoke much about his job with his wife or his family. He would always kind of leave the answers short and things like that. I think for their peace of mind, I guess.
Maybe not to scare his family.
Yeah, and I think when you're in that type of field and doing those kinds of things, you see stuff that no one should really see.
Right. And maybe that's the only way that you can, like, punch out and be done for the day.
Yeah.
Is to not bring it up again at home.
Right.
Like, there's boundaries.
You don't want it to consume your life.
Yeah.
For sure.
Although, if I was his wife, tell me everything.
I need to know
tell me
the
it
details.
All.
Now, almost immediately after these bodies were found, it was all over the news media. All the news channels were covering it and wanting as much information as they could get from the King County Police. Dave tells us that the sheriff of King County announced that he was creating a Green River Task Force, and Dave was asked to be the lead detective. This was his first serial murder case that he had ever been assigned. The task force was comprised of 25 detectives, one of which was Faye Brooks. We meet Faye Brooks, and she is the detective in the King County Sheriff's Office, And she says that she had been working for the sheriff's office for about 4 years. At that time, she was in the sex crimes unit, not the homicide unit. With major cases, sex crimes detectives would step in and help the homicide detectives. I think because they can be pretty closely related.
Well, and a lot of them have a lot of sexual aggression tied to them.
Exactly. And Faye herself is a survivor of sex abuse, so being a sex crimes investigator is sort of like therapy for her. I bet it could be.
I mean, aren't we all?
I
97%, right?
For sure.
That's what TikTok keeps telling me.
For sure. And especially if you can be the one to capture these people who are doing these horrible things to women, you just feel like you're
vindicated.
Yes, absolutely. You feel so good, and like it can help you deal with your own traumas.
For sure. Yeah, you couldn't help yourself, but you're helping others.
Exactly. Now, Dave says that during the autopsies of these five women, the medical examiner was able to conclude that sperm was found in two of the victims. This was the first real piece of evidence that they had on this guy. But since this was in the 80s, DNA was not yet advanced enough to develop an actual profile of the killer. How maddening.
I know.
Back in the 70s and 80s when fucking serial killers were everywhere in the U.S.
Everywhere.
Everywhere.
Like, one out of four people was a serial killer.
It was nuts.
And they all lived in the Pacific Northwest. They weren't allowed past that point.
No, it was, I think all they had at that point was like, they could compare blood to see if it was the same blood type. They couldn't even tell you who the blood came from.
Nope.
It was so minimal at that point. I mean, thankfully, they had the foresight to be like, okay, this possibly could be tested in the future, and we need to keep this stuff really, really tied down. We need to secure this evidence and make sure nothing damages it in any sort of way.
Right.
So thankfully, because that's how we've been able to catch all these goddamn killers so many years later, is because of this stuff and DNA ancestry.
I was going to say, and 23andMe.
It's amazing. It's so awesome.
I know, which is why I won't do it.
Right.
Because I don't want to get caught.
Don't worry about what I'm doing.
Eyes over here, Susan.
Faye knew they needed to start focusing on who the women were so they could help narrow things down. Maybe they had some sort of connection between them. Maybe they knew the same people, hung out in the same crowds. They needed to figure it all out.
Yeah.
They did identify some of the bodies through dental records, fingerprints, and missing person reports that had been issued. And they discovered that all of them were sex workers. One of the victims went by the name Marcia Chapman. Right as Faye heard the name Marcia Chapman, it rang a bell in her mind. She knew who this was or knew of her in some way. She recalled being assigned to Marcia's case where she had reported being assaulted. As a 31-year-old mother of three, Marcia got into sex work to take care of her family, and now she was gone. Like, it was really, really sad. I mean, she has three children that are now without a mother.
Right.
And no one knew what happened to her or why.
Yeah, she just disappeared.
Yeah.
I mean, until her body was found.
Exactly. Now, a lot of the sex work in King County occurred in an area known as the Strip. So, of course, they made this location a focal point in their investigation. They needed to stay around. They needed to check things out. Maybe they would run into the killer. Maybe they'd be able to find him in some way, shape, or form, or at least get information from the women to say, hey, I've known this guy to be dangerous.
Right.
I've had an encounter with him myself. You need to check him out.
Yeah.
So this area, known as the Strip, is actually a highway along Pacific Highway South that goes between Seattle, Washington and Tacoma, Washington. Most of these sex workers were young, teens, and early 20s. Which even, oh, God.
I know.
Young teens? Ugh.
I know.
Some of the ages, it's just like, it's so sad. It breaks my heart.
Yes.
That women, I don't even see them as women. I see them
as girls. No, those are girls.
Are out there doing sex work because they have nothing else. Right. They can't do anything else. It's like, why is that happening in this country? It's so fucking sad.
I know.
Faye made sure to go out and warn these women of the potential serial killer that was out there killing sex workers. Most of these women never thought it would happen to them.
Detective Reichert tells us that the case began to grow and made an even bigger impact on the community. It created an atmosphere of fear, and there were lots of calls on suspicious people coming in. He received a call from a man who identified himself as Melvin Foster. Melvin reported a man named Dan Smith saying that he would be a good suspect in this case. Melvin claims that Dan Smith had known the victims and most of the girls on the street and was known to be a violent person. So, of course, detectives are going to go interview Dan Smith, but nothing in their interview pointed to him being even potentially the killer.
Right.
So it was just kind of like, okay, thanks for that. It was out of left field.
Yeah. Right.
Now, detectives knew that the FBI had warned them that the killer may call in and inject himself into the investigation, possibly trying to lead them down a different path, which any true crime knows.
Yes.
Right?
Absolutely. They want to see what direction the police are going and if they're hot on their trail yet.
Right.
Or even close.
Yeah. And some of them are doing it just to kind of toy with them because they know that they're not quite close to getting caught.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So instead, they decide to look at Melvin Foster himself. Now, Melvin was a cab driver in his mid-40s. He lived near Olympia, Washington, which is about an hour and a half south of Seattle. He'd driven to Seattle to operate his cab on the Strip, which was very odd because right. Olympia was a big enough of a city that he could have been just as successful out there.
He could have gotten just as many fares and probably made just the same amount of money, but why are you driving so far?
Why are you driving so far? And working a strip or, you know, a strip of highway that is known for mostly sex work.
Right.
It's not like the Vegas Strip, right? Where right. there's a ton of, like, people and tourists and whatnot. They find out that Melvin also had warrants out for his arrest for traffic violations and that he had been to jail for auto theft. So all of these things are red flags on Melvin himself.
Right.
Not necessarily on this case, but like,
I kind of laughed.
I did too.
when Dave Reichert said that about like he discovered that he had warrants too. It's like, why would you insert yourself into a murder case where police can look up your information and know that you have warrants out for your arrest? Like, what are you thinking? Are you not thinking at all?
Not thinking.
I just laughed.
So detectives bring him in for an interview. They show him victim photographs, but he denies knowing any of them. At the end of the interview, police let him know he's going to go to jail because he has outstanding warrants.
Right.
They decide to do this for two reasons. One, because he obviously needed to be arrested. He has warrants. But also, they figured by throwing him in jail for the night, it could raise his stress level and maybe get him to act out or do something that would point to him being the person that they're looking for.
Right, exactly.
The next day, he does now decide to admit to knowing the victims and that he had had some of them in his cab.
Interesting how his story changed.
I mean, stress does a lot to people.
Hmm.
They think, could this be their suspect? They decide to give him a polygraph test. He's asked if he knows the Green River Killer. He says no. He's asked if he had anything to do with the Green River Killer murders. He says no. At the end, though, the test showed that he had failed the polygraph. But maybe he just has test anxiety, Kenzie.
I think so. This is why we can't rely on polygraphs, because I think even if you are innocent, you can still have raised blood pressure because you're nervous as fuck.
I mean,
just because you're in a stressful situation, like you're in a police station, they think that you did something and you know you didn't, but they're asking you questions and you're nervous. I would fail a polygraph right now for a crime I knew nothing about that could be in a different country because I'd be terrified to be at the police station. Like,
same.
Legit. So that's why, like, thankfully they don't use that in court to like say, oh, you're guilty or not.
Right.
But at this point, why do we even do them?
Why do we do that?
They aren't reliable. And we know that. Everyone knows that. I think they want to have like some sort of a edge maybe to say, okay, well, it's showing that he's not truthful. It's like, is he really not being truthful? Or is it because his stress level is up?
Right.
We don't know.
Yeah, we don't know. And is it just another way to try to coerce somebody into saying things that they wouldn't actually say?
Exactly.
Right?
Right.
Because now they're like, oh, well, this shows that you're not being truthful. And now they're like, well, shit, maybe I should confess. Never confess.
Right.
Never fucking confess.
Get a lawyer.
Who are these people that confess to things they didn't fucking do?
Get a lawyer before you do anything.
Really. Be those people who blame others for everything. Those people don't get caught. Now, because he failed the polygraph, they can't arrest him, but they do decide to put him under surveillance. So they start watching him 24 hours a day, tailing him, watching him on his, what, runs? I don't know, his job? I don't know what to call it. His drives?
It's nonstop. They are following him, tailing him everywhere. Even if he's at home, sleeping.
Just keeping an eye out.
They're always making sure they know what he's doing, where he is, to see if he does anything that shows, like,
suspicious tendencies.
Getting rid of evidence. If he does, right. You know what I mean? If he does something that seems weird, they want to know what he's doing at all times, which makes sense.
Absolutely. But then, back at the task force office, suddenly, Melvin Foster is all over the news, calling attention to the fact that police were following him. So he's on there like, let me just tell you guys what's happening.
Yeah.
Something that he says struck me as super weird. They're asking him if he's scared about the police following him. And he says, quote, scared? No. Fear is for the guilty, unquote. The reporter says, bottom line, did you kill all these women or what? And Foster replies, after a long pause, a creepy long pause.
He's creepy
anyway.
And he's
creepy AF. Like, if he was my cab driver, I'd be like, you can let me out at the next block, please.
I'm not going to get
in. I'm going to walk.
Yeah. I think it's a nice night out. I'm gonna
beautiful outside.
Brisk night. Gonna walk.
I may even jog. Yeah. And I don't jog.
In the opposite direction of you,
the opposite direction. But he says, quote, no, but I wish I did. I wish I did know who did, because I'd have to put a stop to him, end quote. He has crazy eyes, you guys.
He said it so weird, though. The question he was asked was worded.
Did you kill all these women or what? No, but I wish I did.
Which was so weird. So
it's
I think
so weird.
He got caught up in his words or something, but why?
This is why he's a cab driver
weird.
And not a, I don't know, a
I don't know what you're going to say.
I was trying to think of something that spoke, like someone who spoke a lot, but that we're just going to cut that part. We can make this fun.
Yeah.
What they realized was that Foster loved the attention, and FBI profilers had also said that this is typical behavior of a suspect. But each investigator had a stack of like 20 different suspects that they were looking at. So command staff felt that it was costing them way too much money to keep surveillance on Melvin Foster, but still hoping that he'd slip up, make a mistake, and, I mean, be guilty, right?
Yeah.
In 1983, we're hearing news reports. I just kind of summed them up. So the first one, we hear elderly man finds skeletal remains scattered in his apple field. And then another one, three skeletal remains found on port property. Detective Reichert tells us that by now, they had 13 bodies over the last 18 months. And they had to expand the Green River Task Force by 15 officers and 10 detectives. So this is massive.
Nuts. They started with 25, remember, already. And they had to add in 25 more.
Yeah, that's 50.
We can do math. But think about that. 50 people chasing after one person.
No.
And they still can't find him.
Yeah.
Nuts.
We meet Detective Tom Jensen. Tom says that he came back to Seattle after getting out of the Navy, and he was hired in 1972, the same year as Detective Reichert. He was known to be a smart, thorough, and talented investigator, and had been in burglary and larceny for 6 years prior. But he was super excited to work on such a high-profile case. Detective Reichert says that with many tips and suspects, still no one had reached the same level of suspicion as Melvin Foster. He was still kind of like right there, but, you know, not there.
And because they still couldn't get anything on him.
Right.
But he just was acting weird. So,
super
like,
weird.
That failed polygraph test, the way he was acting, made things like he's still at the top of the list. They don't have anything else to go off of. So,
right. No one else is
there's nothing
up
else
that
there.
Much. Yeah. So he decides to give Tom Jensen the task of specifically looking at Melvin Foster to see if he could link anything together. Because Tom was smart like that. Mm-hmm. He could make these things happen. Detective Jensen says that he spent a lot of time trying to prove Melvin didn't do it so that they could just move on to the next guy.
Yeah.
but he was so fucking suspicious.
Yeah, so it was literally like the opposite of what they normally do.
Yeah.
Right? They normally are trying to get all the evidence against you to convict you and hopefully send you to prison. But they're like, we just still don't have anything on this guy. We need to like try and make him not a suspect anymore
get
so we can
rid of him.
Start over and move forward.
Right. So, of course, they have to determine if he was even available for all of these crimes. But a number of women had disappeared while he had been under surveillance, ultimately determining that Melvin Foster couldn't have done these murders,
right.
Or at least not all of them, right?
I mean, I think that was probably what the police needed at that time to really move away from him, because they were putting way too much time and money and resources into him, and they had nothing. So now this proved that someone was still out there killing. Someone was still doing the same exact thing, killing these women in the same exact manner. It can't be Melvin.
No.
He was watched the whole time.
Yeah. Melvin is awkward. Who
he's
would
weird.
Have gotten that close to him?
And he's creepy looking.
He's
a creepy dude.
He's creepy. Detective Faye Brooks tells us that with so much media attention and fear over the sheer number of bodies found, they were under some intense pressure to give updates to the news, and sometimes daily. Like,
oh,
they
yeah.
wanted info now.
Well, the community was terrified.
Right.
They didn't know who was going to be next. And a lot of these sex workers, they really didn't think it was going to happen to them.
Well, who does?
Right. And this guy must have been pretty savvy and knew how to talk to these women and make them feel comfortable, right? To get them in the vehicle, you know, with him and make them feel like they're not in danger.
Yeah. And at this point, everybody's thinking Melvin Foster. And he's been all over the news.
Right.
So they see a face and they're like, okay,
now
we're steering
I feel safe.
Clear of that guy.
And now I feel a little bit safer.
Right. Detective Brooks tells us that there was also a protest about the investigation because people thought that there wasn't enough being done because they were all sex workers and an arrest had not yet been made. But Detective Riker assures us that was not the case. These were little girls, first and foremost, someone's daughters. He didn't look at their occupation or what they were doing. These were women and girls, and they needed to be found.
And I think that's how it always should be. Who gives a shit what someone does for their job? That should not determine whether or not them as a human being should be found or not. And they should get justice if they were murdered. You know, it shouldn't matter. I mean, we should want to get justice for every single person who's ever been murdered, right? I mean, that should be a common consensus, unless
they're a politician.
Or someone in prison murders another person that murdered someone. You know,
but they're
okay.
in prison.
Yeah.
That's prison rules.
Yeah, prison. I mean,
prison has its own rules, and we're not privy to those.
And I'm okay with like people going out and killing child molesters
for
and,
sure.
And that totally fine.
I will turn a blind eye.
Oh my God. Did you ever hear about the guy who went around with a fucking axe? And because you can see where the child molesters and the sex offenders live.
Oh, right, right.
In
the
your
blue
area.
Dot.
Yeah. He was like, I think he was in Canada or somewhere, Canada, Alaska or somewhere up. I don't know. He just started going to these people's houses and axing them to death and killing them.
Jesus.
He went to prison, but like he got to kill like 5 or 8 of them.
Wow.
I know. That's pretty badass.
I mean, that's kind of... I'm going to have to look that guy up.
I mean, they're shitty people. I mean, they're doing shitty things to innocent little babies. No fucking thank you. We're now at March 21st of 1984, and Tom Jensen tells us that they had been in the office when they got a call that a manager of a baseball field's dog had came home with a bone that looked human. The manager shown officers where the dog had been, and they went into the wooded area and did find human remains. The remains found were in a wet, boggy area and completely skeletonized, almost in a fetal position. Oh my gosh, you guys.
Could you fucking imagine if your dog ran up to you with a freaking femur or something in his mouth?
No, no.
Or like a hand or a foot?
No, I can't. And just to find someone like that, their bones were like that.
Yeah.
Oh my God, that,
no, that's...
I could never get it out of my mind.
No.
It would never leave my mind.
No.
The medical examiner was able to determine that this person was anywhere from 12 to 18 years old simply based on the size of the bones.
Baby.
Oh my God. 12, you guys. 12. That is your daughter.
Yeah.
That's the size of your daughter. Like, that is terrifying.
I know.
To think that someone could do something like that to a child. Like, murder's never good. And I think we repeat this almost every episode. Murder isn't good.
It's not good most of the time.
But
sometimes it's good. But in this case, absolutely not.
To children,
no.
Never. Fucking never. Children do not deserve to die by murder. Ever.
No.
They're innocent. They don't know anything yet. Like, there's no reason.
The body they found was identified as Bones 10, since they did not know her identity yet. This was his first homicide crime scene. Tom Jensen's.
Yeah, and he was choking up talking about it.
He was. Oh, still to this day. And he's well into his age. I mean, he's been retired, all that kind of stuff. But, like, it still really, really affects him.
This one stuck with him.
For sure.
They brought out a bloodhound the next day, and it tracked down the scent of death and located another body under a pine tree nearby.
Another one!
Oh my god, you guys. Like, it's like dumping grounds for bodies. Like, what is going on?
The second victim, however, was almost immediately identified by dental records, and they were able to conclude that she was also involved in sex work. This was just the beginning of what they would find in 1984 that completely swamped them. They were finding bodies almost on a daily basis at this point.
Fucking A.
A daily basis? Like, you have to think, okay, this guy, he must not be doing anything else except killing.
Right.
Or he had gone so long killing before they found out, and now they're just finding all of these bodies.
I think that's what it was. They're finding all of his bodies.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
It is horrifying.
For sure.
Horrifying. Now, at this time, a news reporter states, quote, "The Green River Killer has taken at least 20 lives in 21 months. That gruesome total, putting it amongst the largest mass murders in American history," end quote.
Jeez.
20 people. Just imagine, put it, like, 20 people in a room. That's a lot of people.
It's a lot of people.
It's crazy. Detective Faye Brooks explains that the pressure to find this killer was coming from all angles at this point. They all continued to bounce ideas off of one another. They needed to try to stay as motivated as possible and not feel so discouraged. I mean, they had people hounding them for answers, and they were trying their best. They didn't even know where to start and look. Again, they didn't have these DNA matching type of devices that they could just be like, hey, this is who it is, and go arrest them. They didn't have that.
Right.
So they really had to work hard to find these killers. In 1984, the task force took part in a public service announcement called Someone Out There Knows Something. They did this in hopes people would call in if they knew anything about the Green River Killer. They decided to offer up $100,000 to anyone that could give them information that would lead to the arrest of the Green River Killer and end the serial killer's rampage. Now, think about this. This is back in 1984.
How much money was that back then?
I was wondering. I was thinking it was probably $500,000.
We're going to Google that shit right now. It's equivalent to about $344,000. So...
that's a lot of money back then.
It's over a quarter million.
That was a lot of money back then.
It's a lot of money now.
It is a lot.
I'd take
$100,000. I would too. Offering up this type of money created an overflow of tips from the community. Basically, everyone is telling on everyone at this point. Anyone they think could possibly have done this, they're telling on them.
I mean, I would.
Now, Tom tells us that they had thousands of tips called in, whether it was about a missing person, a possible victim, or a potential suspect. Dave goes on to say that a young girl named Rebecca came to them wanting to report an assault. This assault happened 2 years earlier in 1982. She had been picked up by a John, and to ensure that he wasn't a police officer, he showed her his ID, an employment card for Kenworth Trucking. She gets in his truck, and they drive to a secluded wooded area.
A secluded fuck? No,
man. In a truck? I'd be giving blowies right there on the strip. No one's going to see you. A secluded wooded area.
Nope.
Abso-fucking-lutely not.
Nope.
Absolutely not. Nope. I wouldn't go there even for fun. No fucking thank you. Like,
I mean, I might. But no, not with somebody I just met.
Oh, nope. Nope. I need a clean. The outside is not for me. It's just not for me.
That's a no. How about no?
Bang, no. I know. Jared keeps asking. He's like, can we go out like on a road trip? He really wants to go to like the Grand Canyon and do all that. And I'm like... it's gonna have to be a no for me. Unless it includes a flight and a hotel. I don't know about that.
We could do like a day pass, right? But this whole traveling with you in a car, that's a no.
Or he was talking about renting an RV. Oh, I don't know about that. I don't know. Maybe one day, but not now. Now, during oral sex, This man starts to choke her. This is when she knew he was trying to take her life. So clearly, he was choking her hard enough that this was not like a kink or like a sexual type of play. Like, it was violent.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I'm already on my knees doing something for you. Get your fucking hands off me. And don't you dare put your hands on the back of my head and try to guide me.
Never.
Never. Dude, keep your fucking hands to yourself, sir. I got this.
It's a public service.
I got this. Not my first rodeo. Again, I'm sorry, Mom.
I know. I was just saying, Moms, listen to this.
It's whatever. We're married women. Do they think we haven't done that? Sorry, Mom.
Thankfully, Rebecca was able to fight him off and escape. She wanted to come in to share her story just in case that could have been the Green River Killer.
That's crazy.
I know, especially 2 years after the fact.
Well, like, how was she able to escape? You know what I mean?
Right.
And how many others were there that escaped?
Right.
Maybe there were many others.
Yeah. It's scary. It's really scary to think about.
Right?
One of the detectives had been looking through some male profiles that had been arrested for frequenting sex workers, and he came across one individual that listed his employment as Kenworth Trucking. Oh, it's fucking gold.
It is.
It's so amazing. Now, Detective Reichert tells us that the detectives were able to show Rebecca a photo lineup that included this guy's mugshot. She's not just going to show her him specifically.
No. Well, they want to see her actually catch this guy by pointing him out without being led that way.
Exactly. Now, she was able to positively identify that guy as the man who tried to kill her a few years back. She identifies Gary Ridgway. Gary was 35. He was married and had a son. He had been arrested in early 1982 for patronizing a sex worker and did serve jail time for it. Immediately after this discovery, they find Ridgway and interview him. Now we get to see a recorded interview with Gary Ridgway. Reichert asks, "In November 1982, were you driving on Pacific Highway? And did you pick up a young lady?" Ridgway states, quote, "Yes, I did," end quote. Reichert continues, "What happens when you got down to the area of 22nd South and South 24th? Ridgway states, quote, "She gave me head, she bit me, and I choked her," end quote. Dave remembers that he was just so calm and like matter of fact in retelling the story.
Well, and you can hear it in the recording.
It's creepy.
And he has such a gross voice.
Well, he's just disgusting overall, but you can tell he has no remorse for what he did.
No.
He does not give a shit.
No.
Dave then asks, "How long did you choke her?" And he replies, quote, 10, 15 seconds or so. After this interview with Gary Ridgway, the investigation into him really ramps up. They're like, okay, this most likely is our guy. Detective Reichert tells us they found out in 1983, the Port of Seattle police had made a traffic stop on Ridgway. A young girl named Kelly McGinnis was in the truck with him. She also was a sex worker. Kelly McGinnis was now a missing person. Ridgway was their top priority suspect.
Yeah, could this be another Green River victim?
Oh my God. It's just one after another with this guy. Now they get a search warrant for his house and his person, of course. They wanted to collect bodily fluid from him. They wanted to find that one piece of evidence that would break this case open. Again, at some point, they want to connect his bodily fluid with the fluid they found in the victims. So they want to see if that some time when they can actually match those two, that they'll be a match.
Yeah. Well, right now they have enough reason to collect that from him.
Exactly. One team of detectives went to Ridgway's work and picked him up. There was another team of detectives that went and searched his home. Their hope was to find blood or items that belonged to any of the victims, but unfortunately, they were not able to find anything that linked him to any of the murders. The other team collected Gary's DNA by having him chew on a piece of gauze. At that time, they were hoping they would be able to match the blood type to the killer. Because again, that's all they had.
Yeah. But that was also weird.
It was weird. What blood? What are they trying? What?
Did they make him bite his tongue first? Or were they thinking that the saliva could be connected to his blood type?
That's what it was.
That's what it was. And the thing is like, this is why they're not scientists. Because saliva and blood types are very different.
Right.
Bodily fluids.
And unfortunately, they realize that that's not how it works.
Right.
at first, they did get really, really excited because they thought that this may be the break that they were hoping for. It didn't pan out. All they could do at this point was freeze the saliva sample that they had for potential use in the future. At this point, they still were unable to get a single piece of physical evidence that would link him to the cases. So they can't even arrest him at this point. They have nothing on him and they do not have a strong enough case. Detective Riker says they always wondered, what are we missing? And they could only hope that no one else would get killed. I mean, obviously, but doesn't look like there was an end in sight with this guy. Like, he didn't want to stop.
It's like every time they feel like they get a step ahead, more bodies show up.
Yes, and now they're two or three steps back, you know, from their original investigation because they still don't have anything. They do think it's him, but they don't have any physical evidence connecting him.
Yeah, they can't prove it.
Exactly. We hear another news reporter, quote, in the midst of a brand new apartment complex, construction workers unearthed the skeletal remains of the Green River Killer's latest victim. Despite 60 detectives assigned to the murders and the expenditure of $15 million, there's no arrests, end quote. I was like, the shade that this reporter is throwing at the fucking police station.
Ouch.
I know. It's like, it's not like they're not fucking trying, but like, you can only do so much. What are you going to do with nothing? No physical evidence that connects him. You can't just arrest him because you think it's him. You have to have enough evidence to convict.
Right.
Otherwise, you'll get screwed. Because
right.
if
Without
you try
enough.
Yeah. Or if you try to take him to trial and he gets found not guilty, you can't charge him again for that crime.
You're fucked.
That's it. You're done.
It's done.
Now, a few months later, the sheriff brought up the amount of money that was being spent on this investigation to Dave Reichert. And there was a belief that they wouldn't be able to catch this killer, so they made the decision to start cutting down the task force. He was appalled. How could they just stop investigating a case with so many murdered girls? Eventually, Tom was the only one left there full time.
It's crazy.
Tom tells us that he needed to bring a conclusion to all of this for all the victims and their families. He would help on other cases from time to time, but refused to be taken away from the Green River case.
We're now jumping ahead quite a few years, and it's now 1997. Detective Riker tells us that since 1990, he'd been thinking about this case all of the time. He says that he was elected sheriff in 1997 of King County, and now he could make decisions on the
case.
Yes,
yes, he could change things.
Detective Jensen says that he told Reichert how science had come a long way since, you know, the late 80s.
For sure.
And maybe now is a good time to try those samples again. So Detective Reichert takes those samples of saliva and starts comparing them against the sperm samples collected from the victims from 1982. Detective Faye Brooks was chief of criminal investigations at the time, and remembers being asked for a meeting with Jensen and Reichert. Something really important needed to be shared. And she's like, what the fuck's happening?
Mm-hmm.
So they get together. Detective Jensen tells us he almost couldn't speak. He was stunned, literally stunned, and tells them that they had a DNA match. Detective Reichert looks at me. He says, are you saying we know who the Green River Killer is? Jensen pulls out an envelope with the mugshot of Gary Ridgway. It was quite the moment. All of them, like all three of these detectives, are choked up thinking about the moment that they discovered Gary Ridgway was, in fact, the Green River Killer.
This literally gave me goosebumps.
Side note, Gary Ridgway, GR, Green River, GR.
Oh, shit.
Yeah.
Did not know that.
Yeah.
Crazy. I was watching it, and obviously I knew who it was at this point because this happened a while ago, but still, like, I got goosebumps just living through them, you know, to imagine how much excitement they had to finally pin this on him and get him convicted and sentenced to life in prison. Like, finally, they could go arrest him.
Literally, it had been 19 years.
Crazy.
And they're showing footage of arresting Gary Ridgway.
Yes.
They said he would have gotten the death penalty, but he accepted a deal to tell the truth and give up all of the bodies and all of their locations. We see some video footage from his arrest time, and Gary Ridgway is stating, quote, why did I hate them? Because they, women, had control of me, and I don't like being controlled. I always thought I was doing you guys a favor.
killing prostitutes here. You guys can't control them, but I can. End quote. Like, I'm sorry, do you think you're like a modern day Batman? And what are these sex workers doing to you?
And for him to assume that the cops needed his help, as if they asked him.
He's a truck driver.
He was just so like, well, I don't know why you're mad. I was doing it for you. It's like, you can't just fucking kill people because of what they do for a living. Like, you're not fucking God here. You can't determine who lives and who dies.
No.
You know, it fucking made me mad the way he talked about it. It was just like, well, shit.
Yeah, kind of like,
I was helping you out.
No credit?
Like, what the fuck? God damn it. Thank God this motherfucker is in prison. Thank God.
Is he or is he dead by now?
No, he's not.
No, because that was only in the late 90s.
Yeah, and he's, I mean, I think he's in his 60s, I would say. 50s, 60s, maybe? I don't know.
Something like that. Detective Jensen says that he took them all to a lot of the sites where bodies have been dumped. And they were able to file an additional 40 counts of murder on this man.
What the fuck? 40 more on top of the other people he already killed.
Detective Reichert remembers the courtroom that day when Ridgway came in. It was packed. He said he stood and pled guilty to every single one of the girls' names that were called out. We see some on-screen text that says Gary Ridgway was sentenced to life in prison for the murder of 49 women. So that's 49 that they were able to confirm.
Exactly.
Detective Faye Brooks still gets chills thinking about how she was able to help solve this case and put this man behind bars. Detective Riker tells a little story about Gary Ridgway walking past him in court that day. Yes. And Riker looks at him and says, "Gotcha, asshole." And he says it. So, I mean, I love it. And he goes, "I know it's not like the most professional thing that I could have done.
It was a little cheesy.
But it felt good." I totally get it.
I would have to say something, especially after all the years of searching for this guy and you finally get him and you know he's never leaving prison. You'd want to punch him in the fucking face, but you can't do that, you know?
Verbal punch.
Yeah, exactly.
Detective Jensen says that he ended up retiring at the end of 2012. He says that he works voluntarily to identify some of these victims still. And in late 2020, the remains of the girl at that baseball field were finally identified. They were the remains of Wendy Stevens of Denver, Colorado. She had run away from home when she was 14. It took 30 years to identify her body.
Oh my gosh.
And he says that there are still some unidentified victims from that case.
Oh my gosh. And you know what? Unfortunately, as time goes on, it's going to be so hard to identify people. The longer time goes on, it's hard even to find some of these people. You know what I mean? It's sad. I completely didn't realize that they still had unidentified victims today. I did not know that. I thought that, like, they knew who they all were. I mean, this case is so old at this point. I mean, the early 80s.
Mm-hmm.
The early 80s, this guy started killing. Oh, man. The damage that one fucking person can do is crazy.
It's unbelievable.
It's fucking crazy.
Unbelievable. That is the episode on Catching Killers of the Green River Killer.
Yes. And actually, it's funny that we were just talking about if he's still alive. I did actually look it up and I forgot that I did. He is still alive and he's currently living in the Washington State Penitentiary in Walla Walla, Washington. And in his Wikipedia page, I saw a list of his victims and suspected victims.
Yeah.
And it is fucking scary how long you have to scroll.
I bet.
It is like, oh my God, it literally just makes you sick.
Yeah.
Because, like, all of these people were fucking human beings that were loved by other people. And one fucking person took them out of this world.
Yeah.
It's not fucking fair. It's really not fair. Thanks so much for tuning in this week to another episode of Sheer Crime. Next time, we will be going back to the Hulu documentary series, The Killer Speaks, and covering the case on Earl Forrest. Just a few weeks before Christmas, Earl went to his friend's house and gunned down two people in cold blood, but it didn't end there. By the end of the night, four more people were shot. You won't want to miss it. If you would like to follow us on social media, you can follow us in our Facebook group, Sheer Crime Podcast Discussion Group. We are having so much fun, as usual.
It's awesome.
Seeing more people get added every day and want to join our group. It's so fun. Love it.
Well, and we have like a fan favorite out there.
We do.
Miss J. Clark.
Yes.
Miss J. Clark. She is amazing.
She is wonderful.
She is
we love
so
you,
Jay. Interactive. I love it. Every time I see her, I immediately click on. I'm like, what is Jay saying?
Yes. What kind of conversation are we having today?
Right.
We are also on Instagram at @sheer_crime_podcast, Twitter at @sheercrimepod, TikTok at @sheercrimepodcast, and of course our email inbox, requests@sheercrimepodcast.com. We are so grateful that you've all been so patient with us over the past few months. We love you all and appreciate your support. As always, stay safe, stay sane, and remember, never run with scissors. Bye, guys.
Bye.